This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Harsh language today from Moscow and Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. Russia's President Dmitry Medvedev called his Georgian counterpart, Mikhail Saakashvili, a liar. The Georgian president said he'll regard Russian peacekeepers in two rebellious provinces as an army of occupation. But after 5 days of fighting, the conflict between Russia and Georgia appears to be moving toward a war of words as agreement nears on a ceasefire and a peace agreement. Still, the situation remains extremely volatile, and it's hard to estimate how long any agreement might hold. What is clear is that the fate of two Georgian provinces whose names most Americans never heard of until a week ago are critically important, and not just to Georgia and to Russia. Ukraine fears it might be next. The European Union worries about its dependence on Russian oil and gas. NATO and the United States are concerned that they have so little influence on this crisis. If you have questions about the conflict in South Ossetia or its repercussions, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, the Commerce Department releases trade deficit numbers for June, and we ask NPR's Adam Davidson what that number means as we launch the Econonaut. But first, the conflict in Georgia, and we begin with James Traub, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. You can find a link to his most recent article, Taunting the Bear, on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And James Traub joins us today from Buenos Aires, and it's nice to have you with us today.
Well, thanks very much.
And is it fair to say that from Georgia's point of view, what's at stake is, well, everything?
Everything. I mean, you know, the Georgians are such a melodramatic bunch, you know, and when I was there, they all spoke of the of world historical stakes. This is not just about Georgia. It's about the whole neighborhood. It's not just about the whole neighborhood. It's about Europe. It all seemed a little hysterical. But, of course, that was before Russia did something that I don't think anybody, certainly including the Georgians, would have imagined that they would do, which is to actually invade Georgia's territory, to violate Georgia's sovereignty.
And that, of course, after Georgia seemed to, make a tactical mistake, or maybe a bigger mistake than that, by trying to move its forces into the breakaway province of South Ossetia.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a big piece of this which is still murky that I don't know the answer to, and I haven't seen a clear answer to, which is what exactly happened, who fired the first shot, how appropriate or inappropriate or disproportional were the responses and all that. So, yeah, I think Georgia probably did something dumb in the way of putting your hand into the lion's cage is a dumb thing to do. And I think the Georgians refused to reckon with the consequences of that. But, of course, the real point is that Russia is acting like the president of Georgia, Saakashvili, when talking to me, used the word crocodile. He said, yes, I understand the logic of the crocodile. He wants to eat your leg, but I want my leg. And so at the time, it seemed a little laughable. But, yes, it seems like Russia is acting like a crocodile.
In your piece, you wrote, the border between Georgia and Russia has been the driest of tinder. The only question was where the fire would start. Well, do you think 5 days of fighting has dampened the crisis?
No. I mean, what it's done is it's redefined the crisis. I mean, until now, you would say here were these two breakaway republics, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, that Georgia claimed as its own for historical reasons, which whatever argument you'd make, the world recognized Georgia's claim to them. Russia had this impartial role as peacekeeper, even though it had been violating that role. Well, that's done. That's finished. At the very least, South Ossetia and Abkhazia are part of Russia today, not officially, not formally, but they are. And so it's going to be a long time before it can even be contemplated that those two places can actually have their future settled in a way that is fair to everybody. So what Russia wanted to do was completely redefine the terms of this ongoing a conflict with Georgia. And they have succeeded in doing that, not only by taking those two provinces, but by making it clear they can crush the Georgian army, and if they wanted to, take Georgia whenever they are of a mind to.
Further down the road, the chairman of NATO said today that organization intends to keep up its pledge that eventually Georgia will be a member. Of course, the Russians say never.
Right. And this was very important news for the Georgians, because even before this war, they felt like the only protection they had was NATO. And this is an incredibly inflamed issue because the Russians object violently to the idea of having a country right on their border as a member of NATO, though already the Baltic countries are members of NATO and they're on Russia's border. And NATO has been trying to make the case, look, we're not an anti-Russian organization. This is the 21st century. The Cold War is over. Now, however, Georgia's bid for membership in NATO, and also Ukraine, another neighbor very much threatened by Russia, now they do look like the meaning of their membership in NATO was not simply, I want to join the West. It's, I want protection from Russia. And so NATO granting membership to them cannot fail to be seen as granting them protection from Russia.
Well, joining us now is Charles King, the chairman of the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. There's a link to his latest article, Russo-Georgia Conflict is Not All Russia's Fault, on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. He's with us from the studio of the BBC in Edinburgh, Scotland, and it's nice to have you with us.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And from Russia's point of view, well, what's at stake here?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that from the point of view of Russian society, this has been an extremely popular war. That is, Saakashvili is perceived in Russia not only among government officials, but at the popular level as being something of a hothead, unpredictable, and again, from a popular point of view in Russia, someone who engaged in really barbaric acts in South Ossetia. Russian news coverage was filled with refugees flooding into southern Russia, the bombardment of the South Ossetian capital of Tskhinvali, really scores, if not hundreds, of people killed in that battle. So the Russian perspective at a popular level is that this is punishment and protection at the same time, punishment for Saakashvili's policies and also protection for the South Ossetians and for the Abkhaz. Russia itself has broader strategic goals, and I think Jim Traub mentioned several of those, and I would agree that those broader goals are certainly there as well.
So to intimidate not just Georgia, but Ukraine, and by extension, NATO and Europe and the United States.
That's right. I think intimidation is part of it, but it's also a demonstration that the language of democracy, the language of U.S. protection, at the end of the day, may be worth less than the Georgians or the Ukrainians or others believe. And that's really one of the very important upshots, I think, of the last several days. And that is a sort of growing dissatisfaction in Georgia about the way that the United States has dealt with this conflict. The U.S., from President Bush to Condi Rice to others, continually talked about Georgia as a major partner of the United States, not an ally yet, but certainly a partner. Many Georgians now feel that when the chips were down, the United States simply wasn't around.
Let's get a caller on the line. If you'd like to join the conversation with James Traub of the New York Times Magazine and Charles King of Georgetown University, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and we'll begin with Mike, and Mike's with us from LeGrand in Oregon.
Hello, I'm here.
Go ahead, please.
My question is this. Did Georgia not understand or understand Russian history? Did they not understand the rise of Russian nationalism in the last several years? Did they not understand the return to power of Russia? Did they not understand their Russian history? They have always done pretty much what they wanted to do without regarding world opinion. Did they not understand that the U.S. policy in the Bush administration has been fairly much laissez-faire towards Russia? Did Georgia not understand, if they actually moved back to retake this province, the depth of the retaliation, and did they think that world opinion would deter the Russians? That's my question.
Okay. Well, Charles King, you wrote about how one party in this has all of the soft power, the rhetorical advantage of the little guy being forced up against the big guy, while the other side had all the hard power.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think this was to a degree a failure of deterrence, but not of not of deterring Russia so much as deterring a U.S. Partner and friend, and that is Georgia. It was very clear, I think, from the beginning that if Georgia moved into South Ossetia or Abkhazia in a major way, Russia was certainly going to respond, if for no other reason than that the majority of citizens of Abkhazia and South Ossetia over the last 15 years have become citizens of the Russian Federation by taking Russian passports. And so this was a very dangerous game that Georgia was playing really from the outset.
And James Trauba, on that broader historical point.
Well, you know, the Georgians are acutely aware of everything your questioner just asked. I mean, I've never heard such anti-Russian views in my life as there. And so, no, they think of the Russians as being beasts. At the same time, they clearly have this deep nationalist drive to retake those two areas. Now, the fact is, at least in Abkhazia, for all of the Georgians' provocations and aggressiveness, the fact is they never did do anything that brought the Russian reaction down on their head. And one reason why I think we need to learn what in fact happened on that day on Friday in Tsikhanveli is that it does seem it would seem like a suicidal act for the Georgians to have begun a war in a way that was big enough that it would bring about a Russian reaction, because it does seem incredibly disingenuous or naive to think that you really could seek to retake South Ossetia by force and not have a Russian reaction. The Georgians tried this 4 years ago in a much more modest way with a relatively small contingent of interior ministry troops. And then they were beaten back just by the South Ossetian irregulars. And so I doubt, though I may be proved wrong, that Saakashvili actually had the plan to, a prior plan, a premeditated plan, to take South Ossetia by force in the belief that the Russians would let him do so. I think, my impression from talking to them a month ago or so, at that time the conversation principally being about Abkhazia, is that they knew that they could win the war, they could win the battle, I'm sorry, on day one. But then starting from day two, the Russians could obliterate them.
Yet politically, we'll talk about this in just a minute, politically, the Georgian president ran on a platform of national reunification and clearly meant Abkhazia and South Ossetia. We'll talk more about that. Mike, thanks very much for the question. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where the Bush administration is reportedly scrambling to find ways to punish Russia for its invasion of Georgia. All options are diplomatic. Western countries could push Russia out of the G8 group of leading nations. The White House may decide to cancel a joint NATO-Russia military exercise that's scheduled to start on Friday, options that would be largely symbolic. We're talking today about what's at stake in this conflict for Georgia, for Russia and the region, and for the United States. Our guests are James Traub, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, and Charles King, chairman of the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, author of The Ghost of Freedom, A History of the Caucasus. If you'd like to speak with them about the conflict in Georgia or its repercussions, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Pete's on the line. Pete calling us from Minneapolis.
My question was, isn't a lot of this about resources, because Georgia sits on a critical pipeline that right now it only carries 1 million barrels of oil, but in the future there's a huge, just vast area of all the former Soviet republics, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, that have tons of oil and gas, and this is the only way to get it to Europe.
Only way to get it to Europe that doesn't go through Russia. James Traub, is that, how much of a factor is that, do you think?
Yeah, no, Pete's question is absolutely right on the mark. Right now, Georgia is the transshipment point for oil, not natural gas, but for an oil pipeline that runs from Azerbaijan, which is a big source of oil, through onwards to Turkey and then to Europe. And Russia has been bombing that pipeline, and from everything I've read, missing so far. But that's clearly one objective. A more serious future objective, though, is that there is talk about building a natural gas pipeline. And natural gas is a more crucial resource than oil. You can get oil anywhere. It travels in barrels by ships. If you don't get it from one place, you can get it to another. Not true with natural gas. Natural gas has to be delivered by pipeline. So pipelines matter a lot. Russia wants that next pipeline to run through Russia. Georgia, of course, and much of the West, wants to have a pipeline that runs through Georgia. Russia has been trying very hard through a combination of wheedling and threats and so on to prevent that pipeline called Nabucco from being built through Georgia. And so, yes, clearly a very big objective of Russia's is to persuade the world that Georgia is too dangerous a place to allow that to happen, that Russia has to be granted its wish for control over those crucial natural resources.
And let me ask you, Charles King, Russia's ability to exercise leverage by its export of these materials has been absolutely critical in this conflict.
Well, that's certainly right. More broadly, it's been critical in Russia's relationship with Europe and Russia's relationship with many of the former Soviet republics. When they have moved in directions that Russia has not liked, Russia simply turned off the natural gas tap. This has happened in places like Ukraine and Moldova in the past. Certainly, the conflict with Georgia takes things up several notches, though.
Pete, thanks for the call. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to JT. JT with us from Ronkonkoma in New York.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
My real question is how did the Georgians think that the U.S. could possibly come to their rescue, considering our abysmal failures in places like Vietnam and Iraq? How could we confront the Soviet Union when we've been beaten back by third world backwaters that don't even have an air force?
Charles King, what do you think?
Well, it's difficult to know what was actually in President Saakashvili's mind or the minds of his chief advisors late last week. But I do think that that there was a sense among the top leadership in Georgia that Georgia played a special role in U.S. foreign policy. Georgia was the third largest troop contributor in Iraq. President Bush went to Georgia calling it a beacon of democracy. Condoleezza Rice has made several visits there. Georgia has held a kind of pride of place in American foreign policy toward the former Soviet Union from really the first Bush administration through the Clinton administration to the second two, George W. Bush administrations. And so over time, I do believe that the Georgians began to convince themselves that they played a particular role in U.S. foreign policy and that at the end of the day, the United States was going to be there to support them. If not overtly in a military way, then something beyond the mainly symbolic moves that we've seen up to now. At the end of the day, this may be one of the great casualties of the conflict between Russia and Georgia. That is, the sense in Georgia that the United States is going to be there at every step of the way.
Yet if Georgia does become a member of NATO, the United States would be obligated by treaty to be there.
Well, that's certainly right that once Georgia came under the Article 5, so-called Article 5 security guarantees of NATO, an attack on any part of Georgia would be considered the same as an attack on New York or Washington, and the U.S. would be obliged to respond. One has to keep in mind, though, that the U.S. enthusiasm for Georgian membership in NATO has not generally been shared by other NATO allies and partners of the United States, in particular France and Germany. The question now is whether the attack on Georgia by Russia will convince other NATO allies that Georgia needs the protection of the NATO alliance, or if, in fact, Georgia's precipitous actions in South Ossetia convinced the other NATO allies that Georgia really has no place yet in that kind of alliance.
And, James Trapp, you get back to the point that those European countries are dependent on Russian gas and oil.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is really a very deep moment in European history this way, because Russia has violated in an incredibly stark way the most fundamental principles upon which Europe itself is founded. That is, this act of overt territorial aggression, whatever the provocations were in South Ossetia, is genuinely shocking to the European ideal of a kind of a peaceful community of nations. So on the one hand, there is the need to forcibly, strongly respond to this absolutely unacceptable violation. At the same time, Russia is powerful in no small part because it has the hold that comes from its growing economic power, and specifically from oil and gas. Germany gets 40% of its natural gas from Russia. And as Charles rightly said, everybody knows that Russia is willing to use that in a very strong-arm kind of way. They'll make you freeze in the dark if they think it's in their interest. So if the Europeans come to believe that, in fact, they do need to show the Russians that this is unacceptable, what are the means that they will be willing to use, given their fears about infuriating Russia and given Russia's obvious willingness to use those means?
And given the current economic times, which infect Europe as much as the United States, are they going to be willing to devote a greater proportion of their resources to military expenditures?
That's another question. I think the answer to that is clearly no. I mean, maybe in the future they will be. Right now, no. And so, you know, if you pose this question in military terms, there's no answer. I mean, nobody is coming to Georgia's rescue in military terms. The United States isn't going to do so. And I think I should add, in terms of the question that JT had asked, that the Saakashvili and his entourage are not so crazy as to think that the United States would come to their aid in a military way against Russia. They just hoped that the protective umbrella of the United States would act as a deterrent against Russia, which obviously was wrong. So, no, the kinds of responses that are possible don't really have to do with military force or the threat of military force or even an increased military posture. They have much more to do with some of the things you mentioned and Charles mentioned, which is to say NATO membership, G8 membership, membership in the World Trade Organization, possibly even the 2014 Olympics, which are scheduled for Sochi in Russia. There are those kinds of things, some of which are purely emblematic and some of which are actually quite substantive.
JT, thank you. Let's see if we can go now to Shankar. Shankar is with us from Gainesville in Florida.
Yeah, hi. I just had a question for you. The Russians seem to be have made directly the claim of genocide by the Georgian government in their provinces, and that this is their justification not only for invading, but they make a clear parallel between U.S. justifications for intervention, for territorial intervention in Iraq. And I haven't heard any direct repudiation of the facts that the Russians are alleging here, other than sort of psychoanalysis of the Russian motivation. Could you comment on what we actually know about what the Georgians did to civilians in that area?
Charles King?
Well, it really is still very murky. If one followed the Russian television coverage, you saw streams of refugees coming out of South Ossetia, moving into southern Russia, into the very volatile region known as the North Caucasus, where Russia has its own security problems. The city of Tskhinvali, the capital of South Ossetia, we know has by and large been leveled during the fighting. The degree to which that was primarily the Georgians' fault or the South Ossetians' fault or the Russians' fault, it's difficult to know, but British reporters have been in Tskhinvali, so we have independent confirmation of the destruction there. The Russians very early on were saying that upwards of 2,000 people, perhaps more, had been killed in the initial Georgian fight, Georgian-South Ossetian fighting. I think it's pretty clear that the Georgians had no desire to wipe out the Ossetians as an ethnic group on their own territory. But this does play into, the genocide language does play into a broader sense within the Russian Federation and in other parts of the North Caucasus and other parts of the former Soviet Union even, that the Georgians were extremely heavy-handed in the way that they dealt with the South Ossetians this time around, as well as with the Abkhaz and the South Ossetians in the early 1990s, and that they therefore need the protection of the Russian Federation against a revanchist Georgia.
Also, probably fair to point out that the Georgians are taking the Russians to the international court in claims of genocide or ethnic cleansing on the Russians on the Russian side.
That's right. I mean, the language of genocide, ethnic cleansing, who needs the protection of whom, a language that we saw used throughout the wars in the Balkans in the 1990s, that language has been redeployed in the Caucasus.
Thank you, Shankar.
Yeah.
Here's an email question from Chris in Portland, Oregon. I've been wondering what the Russian leadership sees as the difference between Georgia's actions in South Ossetia and its own actions in Chechnya. James Traub, that Chechnya, of course, a province of Russia that tried to break away and was, I don't think flattened is too strong a word.
Yes, and talk about genocide. Leaving aside what anybody's motives are, the capacity of the Georgians to inflict grave harm on a people is nothing compared to the capacity of the Russians. And whatever the Georgians may have done in South Ossetia, and we don't know what that is, cannot begin to compare to what the Russians inflicted on Chechnya. So for Russia to be deploying this language of genocide is really obscenely cynical. And I think just as an almost practical matter, you have to add something else, which is whatever the Georgians did or did not do in South Ossetia, they withdrew. Now, they withdrew not because they didn't want to do any harm. They withdrew because the Russians terrified them. After they withdrew, after the question of harm to South Ossetia had been neutralized by the withdrawal, then Russia invaded Georgian territory. So it's impossible to regard that. No matter what you think about Russia's motives, it's impossible to regard that as an act done to defend citizens at risk of war crimes, ethnic cleansing, genocide. No, it was straightforward territorial aggression.
James Traub, a writer for the New York Times Magazine, also with us, Charles King, chairman of the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. You can see links to their most recent articles on this situation at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's another email question, this one from Buck. With the U.S. military essentially broken and overcommitted, Russia sitting on enough fossil fuel reserves to hold all of Europe hostage, what is to prevent them from reestablishing the old Soviet Union? And James Traub, that is precisely the point that President Saakashvili made, that next will be Ukraine, then the Baltics, and then you have the old Soviet Union.
Yeah, Saakashvili doesn't seem so crazy right now. I think that the difference probably is that it is harder in the world we live in today to actually engage in overt territorial control than it was before. And so the means that Russia uses to assert its control up until now have not actually involved direct military force. They've involved threats, blackmail, things like that, the use of their oil and natural gas, as Charles said. This is the first time they've done this, and I don't know that this means that they will now embark on a campaign of overt territorial aggression. But what it means is that they have said to Georgia and to the world, if you try to ally yourself with the West in our neighborhood, we will prove to you that we have the capacity to do you great harm, and you will find that the West will not come to your aid. That's the message that they want to be sending to the neighborhood, which is why it's so essential for the West to decide on some kind of forceful response.
And Charles King, let me ask you, the Russians had given passports, citizenship, to many of the people in South Ossetia and to the people in Abkhazia, too. Well, there are plenty of people who speak Russian, ethnic Russians in Ukraine and in the Baltic countries as well.
That's right. And this is something that has certainly worried the government in Ukraine for some time, in the Baltics, in Moldova, that Russia's giving of passports rather freely, giving of Russian citizenship to locals to enable them to travel to Russia, to work in the Russian Federation and so forth, would at some stage be used as an excuse for military intervention if things went south in Moldova, which has its own secessionist region known as Transnistria. Would Russia intervene on the same terms to protect Russian citizens there? This is certainly a worry. And as Russia has expanded the number of people in each of these regions that benefit from Russian citizenship, that scenario becomes in some ways more likely.
And at that point, what do you see as the next step, James Traub? We've had this agreement, which may hold and it may not. The French president has obtained some Russian points and presumably will now present that document to the Georgians to see if they're willing to abide by what the Russians have included, including a declaration of that they will refrain from the use of force under any circumstances in South Ossetia. But is this likely to resolve the crisis?
No, I think what it, as I said earlier, what it's done is it's redrawn the lines of the crisis. So there's no question of getting back Abkhazia and South Ossetia. That's done. The Russians have solved that one. And I think the Russians really have stopped. I mean, the latest news is that they still are bombing areas, for example, in western Georgia, Poti, an important port city. They're still bombing in Gori, which is a central city not very far from Tbilisi. Nevertheless, I assume the war part of this is now over. And the part of this that we are now in the middle of is how do we renegotiate our relationship with Russia, our the United States, our the West? How do we protect Georgia from further depredations by Russia? How do we begin what now will be a long-term process of trying to negotiate some kind of solution in Abkhazia and South Ossetia that is, let's say, maximally acceptable to the Russians, the Georgians, and to those people? That's going to be a long, slow, difficult process. So that phase has come to an end, and now we face this other phase where we have a lot of really hard decisions to make.
James Traub of the New York Times Magazine, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
We reached James Traub by phone from Buenos Aires. Charles King is at the studios of the BBC in Edinburgh. Thank you for your time as well.
Thank you. Happy to join you.
Coming up, if you have questions about the economy, our own Adam Davidson has some answers. He translates the economic gobbledygook for us as the Econonaut. This is NPR News.